From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Lou Reed famously said, "I don't like nostalgia unless it's mine." But these days, just about everybody is nostalgic. In fact, our culture is saturated with remembrance of things past, even when the past was about 10 minutes ago. Just ask music critic Simon Reynolds.
What is new, I think, is this sort of fixation on the immediate past. You know, the sort of way the material is available to us in terms of film footage, videos, and that means that retro is a lot more exact in its copying of the past.
Today, a look at rerun culture, from its past to its future. Novelist Ernie Klein turns his obsession with the 80s into the hit novel Ready Player One. And celebrated actor-writer Simon Pegg tips his hat to the geek culture that helped launch his career.
We as human beings in this age, we like being kept in a state of arrested development. And so a lot of mainstream sort of cinematic output is all like, it's kid stuff, it's science fiction, it's superheroes, it's things that are genuinely associated with childhood. And it's all because we have a propensity to not want to grow up and face the facts about the world.
Luke, you do not yet realize your importance. You have only begun to discover your power. Join me, and I will complete your training. With our combined strength, we can end this destructive conflict and bring order to the galaxy.
I'll never join you!
If you only knew the power of the dark side, Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough! He told me you killed him.
No, I am your father.
If you grew up in the 70s and 80s, chances are you've got Star Wars forever burned in your brain. Like many of his generation, the actor Simon Pegg is an unabashed Star Wars junkie. He credits the movie with firing up his imagination and his career. Pegg writes about his cultural sweet spot in the book Nerd Do Well. Today, Pegg is a celebrated writer, director, and actor. He's worked with Quentin Tarantino, Peter Jackson, and, yes, George Lucas. He's created and starred in the cult zombie hit Shaun of the Dead and Paul. Steve Paulson asked him where it all began. According to Pegg, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
I think I was absolutely the correct age for it, and it had a seismic effect on me, as it did on millions and millions of other children, you know.
Now, for people who were not of your age, not of your generation, I think it can be hard to understand why Star Wars had such an impact. What's your theory about that?
I think it's many, many things. For a while when I was a kid, I used to think it was just because it was, just simply because it was a great movie. But there were so many factors involved in creating the cultural phenomenon that is Star Wars at the time. It happened in terms of its release in America. It happened at a very specific time in American history, at a time when America was feeling a particular way after the Vietnam War. It soothed a lot of soreness that America was feeling, and as a result, America went absolutely nuts for it. And when us in the UK felt it coming on the horizon, it rumbled like that Star Destroyer at the beginning into view for us. You know, it was coming for a while, and then suddenly it got there, and it was everything we kind of expected it to be, because as well as being this sort of strange reflection of the American dream as it was at the time, or the way that perhaps the nation wanted to feel, you know, in the light of all this amoral confusion that occurred after the Vietnam War, it's also a cracking film. It's a great adventure. It's full of amazing special effects and fun characters. It hit so many notes correctly, and a lot of things fell into place to make it what it was.
Well, what's interesting is, I mean, looking back, I mean, I watched Star Wars not that long ago, in fact. They can come across as pretty cheesy now, sort of, you know, moments of their time. And I guess the question is, do they still hold up, or were they just kind of movies of their time?
I think it will date, you know, in terms of the special effects, with the way that special effects have evolved since. Obviously, it's a lot cruder than it seemed at the time. At the time, it was cutting edge, and what we were used to was far less than what we saw on screen, so it was amazing to us. Harrison Ford's sideburns are quite big. you know, there's Mark Hamill's hair is very feathery in the first one. But I think really they're more than just, you know, you watch something like, say, Buck Rogers, the TV series that came out around about the same time. It's very 70s. They're all dancing to disco music. Star Wars managed somehow to become timeless by not setting itself in the future in a weird way. You know, Lucas set it in the past, which was a stroke of genius because it immediately didn't assign it to any particular time in Earth history. It was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And as such, it had its own architecture, its own look, its own aesthetic, which kind of marked it out as being timeless. And although there are little signifiers of its Earth age in there, I think it holds up pretty damn well, particularly The Empire Strikes Back, which I think is the best of all of the films. It's far less dated than a lot of cinema of the time, you know.
Hmm. Let me skip ahead in your own career. I mean, what really put you on the map as an actor and as a creative figure in movies and TV was your British TV series Spaced,
yeah,
which was a huge hit in Britain. It's sort of just being discovered in the U.S. right now. And this was kind of sort of playing on that love of sci-fi and pop culture, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, it was really because of people like Kevin Smith who'd just started to, you know, make stuff, you know, like Clerks, as you guys would say. It was a film where people spoke about things like that and didn't worry about people not knowing what they were talking about. And, you know, I saw that film and thought, oh, I could make something where I just spoke about the things that I really like and, you know, trust that there are people out there who'd know what I was talking about. We didn't make Spaced for a mass audience. We made it to speak very, very personally to a small number of people. We just didn't realize how big that small number was.
Who were you trying to speak to with that TV series?
Our friends, you know, like people that were like us, people that, I mean, it was about being in your 20s and not getting married, basically. It was like we were part of a generation that was suddenly given this extension to our youths because the pressure to marry and settle down was so much less. We were given this sort of hiatus from adulthood, but nobody knew what to do with it. It was like, oh, great, we don't have to do this now, so we'll just play video games. Hmm. You know, that was kind of, that was, and watch films.
But then there was also kind of this, you have all these references to pop culture, to past movies. I mean, it's a very knowing series.
Absolutely. And it was for the generation of kids that were brought up, that experienced the cultural earthquake that was Star Wars and the sudden explosion of popular cinema and TV and had basically grown up on a diet. The generation before us was, you know, TV was a novelty. For us, it was a commonplace. And, you know, we grew up on a diet of popular culture. And as such, our frames of reference basically were from popular culture. And Spaced is kind of the story of two people who are recounting their lives and using popular culture as every metaphor. It happens literally in space. You know, they go into a rescue, you know, they rescue their dog from the animal testing laboratory and it's like Mission Impossible or whatever. You know, it's how Tim and Daisy would have recounted their lives. I really like the idea of, as an audience member, having some work to do about, you know, I always relate it back to the time when I saw E.T. and I heard John Williams dropped in a phrase of Yoda's theme from The Empire Strikes Back into the score of E.T. when E.T. sees the kid dressed as Yoda on Halloween. And I remember hearing that music and knowing it and feeling like, I get that. I totally get that. And I wanted to stand up in the theater and say, can you hear that? It's Yoda's music. He's playing it because you can see Yoda. And I remember that sense of like complete fulfillment that I felt. And going into space, I thought, wouldn't it be great if we did that every other second?
I was like you once. I let my principles get in the way sometimes. I punched a bloke in the face once for saying Hawk the Slayer was rubbish.
Good for you.
Yeah, thanks. But that's not the point, Tim. The point is, I was defending the fantasy genre with terminal intensity. The Phantom Menace was 18 months ago, Tim!
I know, Bilbo. Okay, it still hurts. You know, that kid wanted a Jar Jar doll.
Kids like Jar Jar!
Why?
What about the Ewoks? Hey? They were rubbish! You don't complain about them.
Yeah, but Jar Jar Binks makes the Ewoks look like shaft.
I've had enough, Tim.
But Bilbo...
Look, I know how you feel, right? I really do. But this can't go on.
What are you trying to say, Bilbo?
I'm going to have to let you go.
Well, the first movie you did with your buddies and collaborators Nick Frost and Edgar Wright was the zombie film, Shaun of the Dead. And the idea is, how do you survive a zombie takeover So how did you come up with the idea? Did you just sit around playing out various scenarios?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we kind of always talk. I mean, Nick and I always sit in the pub talking about it for hours, about what we do. We go, you know, we get to this place and we get a car and we drive there and what would be the best place to hole up and how would it happen? And you know, we had our plan ready to go. It was like protect and survive. You know, in the 50s, it was nuclear bombs. For us in the 90s, it was zombies.
Where's safe? Where's familiar? Where can I smoke?
Take car, go to Mum's, kill Phil,
sorry,
grab Liz, go to the Winchester, have a nice cold pint, and wait for all this to blow over. How's that for a slice of fried gold?
Yeah, boy!
It is vital that you stay in your homes.
So what, you go hole up in your favorite pub? Is that how you go escape?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. We kind of were sitting in the pub thinking, hey, it wouldn't be bad in here, would it? Because, look, there's really heavy doors and you can't really see. And we'd have enough beer to last us until oblivion. This is great. And so Edgar and I started hatching this idea of what would it be like if, like, a regular, ordinary schmo, you know, found himself amid a zombie apocalypse.
Hmm. Now, we've talked about how you grew up with a lot of the classic science fiction movies and TV shows, and then you're playing Scotty in J.J. Abrams' Star Trek movie.
Yeah.
Must have been kind of a thrill to be asked to do that.
Oh, yeah, more than a thrill. It was giddying. I couldn't believe it when I got the email from J.J. J.J. is very direct as a filmmaker. He doesn't really, you know, beat around the bush. If he wants you to do something, he'll call you personally. They've been casting the whole film and the cast was coming together really well, but they hadn't found their Scotty. And I think JJ just thought, oh, I'll just ask Simon Pegg. You know, he kind of thought, oh, screw it, I'll just call Pegg. And I got an email just saying, literally just said, would you want to play Scotty? And I was just getting off a plane from New York and I opened it and I looked at it and I showed it to my wife. And she, who is Scottish, she burst out laughing. And I was like, what do I do with that? How do I respond to that? Just yes? I can't just write yes back. That would be ridiculous. So I kind of thought about it for a couple of days. And I think JJ thought I didn't want to do it because he was like, oh, okay, fair enough. And I was like, wait. I didn't say I'm not going to do it. I'm just saying I can't just say yes because that's just too huge. And he said, look, you know, the worst thing that can happen is every couple of years we get to hang out and make a fun film. And I thought that was the best argument for going to work I'd ever heard. So I said what I was always going to say, which was yes.
And in the film, you come face to face with one of your idols. In fact, here's a clip of you as Scotty meeting Leonard Nimoy as Spock.
And I know exactly what's going on here, okay? Punishment, isn't it? Ongoing for something that was clearly an accident.
You are Montgomery Scott.
You know him? Hey, that's me. You're in the right place. Unless there's another hard-working, equally starved staff the officer around.
Me.
Get it. Shut up. You don't eat anything. You can eat like a bean and you're done. I'm talking about food. Real food. But you're here now, so thank you. Where is it?
You are, in fact, the Mr. Scott who postulated the theory of transwar beaming.
That's what I'm talking about.
The title of your memoir is Nerd Do Well. And I get the impression that this is a really good time to be a nerd. Maybe better than any other time in history. Would you agree? I mean, is there something about our culture now that values the nerd sensibility?
I think so, but I think it's like this is prior to the fall of the Roman Empire in terms of nerd culture. I think Patton Oswalt wrote a very good article about it, about wake up geek culture, it's time to die. I think what's happened is essentially the corporate mentality has cottoned on to nerd culture as being something that's quite easy to sell. I think we as human beings in this age, and always have been slightly inclined towards infantile regression, we like being kept in a state of arrested development. And so a lot of mainstream sort of cinematic output is all like, it's kid stuff, it's science fiction, it's superheroes, it's things that are genuinely associated with childhood. And that's all because we have a propensity to not want to grow up and face the facts about the world and the universe. And I think what's happened is the marketing machine has realized our need for that, has realized our need for infantile regression and is selling it to us very, very hard. And I think nerd culture has basically been assimilated by the man, and things are going to change pretty soon. There's a storm coming.
This has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Simon Pegg is an actor, writer, and director. He starred in the cult zombie film Shaun of the Dead. And Paul, his memoir is called Nerd Do Well. Steve Paulson spoke with him. If you'd like to find out more about their film or anything else you hear this hour, stop by our website. It's ttbook.org. Tell me, doctor, where are we going this time? Is this the 50s or 1999? All I wanted to do was play. Ernie Cline can't get the 80s out of his head. So instead of kicking his 80s habit to the curb, he's embraced it and written a novel built around the time. It's called Ready Player One. The plot involves an eccentric billionaire named James Halliday who's invented the ultimate virtual reality world, a massively multiplayer online game called Oasis. When he dies, Halliday leaves a hidden clue embedded deep within the game. Whoever finds it is heir to his fortune and fame. What will it take to win? Total immersion in the 1980s world of pop culture. Here's a reading from the book, performed by Will Wheaton.
Everyone my age remembers where they were and what they were doing when they first heard about the contest. I was sitting in my hideout watching cartoons when the news bulletin broke in on my video feed, announcing that James Halliday had died during the night. I'd heard of Halliday, of course. Everyone had. He was the video game designer responsible for creating the Oasis, a massively multiplayer online game that had gradually evolved into the globally networked virtual reality most of humanity now used on a daily basis. The unprecedented success of the Oasis had made Halliday one of the wealthiest people in the world. At first, I couldn't understand why the media was making such a big deal of the billionaire's death. After all, the people of planet Earth had other concerns. The ongoing energy crisis, catastrophic climate change, widespread famine, poverty and disease, half a dozen wars. You know, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria! Normally, the news feeds didn't interrupt everyone's interactive sitcoms and soap operas unless something really major had happened, like the outbreak of some new killer virus or another major city vanishing in a mushroom cloud. Big stuff like that. As famous as he was, Halliday's death should have warranted only a brief segment on the evening news so the unwashed masses could shake their heads in envy when the newscasters announced the obscenely large amount of money that would be doled out to the rich man's heirs. But that was the rub. James Halliday had no heirs.
A reading from the audiobook of Ready Player One, as performed by Will Wheaton. Novelist Ernest Cline told Anne Strangechamps why the 80s pop culture that fills his novel is so compelling to him.
Definitely, I think, as far as movies and the entertainment of the 1980s. I think it was kind of a golden age, especially for movies. Like those movies that came out in the 80s made me want to become a filmmaker and a writer and just have inspired me my whole life. So that was one of the, you know, reasons I wanted to celebrate it. I also think it was kind of a unique time in that it was kind of the birth of the computer era. We were, you know, my generation, we were the first kids to have a home video game console, like a video game in our house, and mm-hmm. and also the first generation to have a home computer, you know, that we would do our homework on. I was very quick to embrace it. And I feel like, you know, kind of the dawn of the internet age all began, you know, and the home computer age all began in the 70s and 80s. So that's one of the reasons I'm fascinated by it.
We should paint a bit of a picture here for those of us who are, you know, either too old or maybe too young to remember that world as intimately as you do. What are some of the main touchstones? You know, take music, for instance.
Of the 80s, I was kind of, back then I was obsessed with the band Rush, which ends up playing a big role in my book. But Rush was kind of like the quintessential rock and roll band for the isolated, outcast, you know, brooding, nerdy teenager, which is what I was. Their lyrics are all about isolation and the individual, and they have big, you know, theatrical, like, science fiction space operas and, you know, just really smart lyrics. And I loved the band Rush so much that I paid tribute to them in my first movie that I wrote, Fanboys, as well. There's a character in that film that's obsessed with Rush.
And what about movies?
Movies? That was another kind of innovation, I think, something new that my generation had that happened in the 80s, late 70s and the 80s, was the advent of home video. You know, we were the first generation to have access to this kind of giant library of movies, whereas previous generations, you know, if you didn't see it in the theater or, you know, catch it later on TV, you didn't get to see it. Whereas once my family got a VHS player, I could, you know, watch this giant library of movies and watch the movies over and over again. And I was, you know, I kind of became a cinephile early on. And the big formative movies for me were the Star Wars movies, obviously, rocked my whole world. And the Back to the Future films I just adored, and the Indiana Jones movies, but also movies like War Games and Real Genius and Better Off Dead. There were all these great comedies and great, you know, thrillers. And
well, so let's talk about the plot of your book, Ready Player One. At the center is this kid, Wade Watts, and a game that, in fact, the entire world is obsessed with.
I wanted to pay tribute to the Roald Dahl stories that I really love. Roald Dahl was one of my favorite writers growing up, and I love the Willy Wonka books. And I also loved James and the Giant Peach, kind of these stories about downtrodden kids in kind of rough circumstances who would something would happen in their life, you know, like the golden ticket contest or, you know, what happened with James and the Giant Peach. You know, something fantastic would happen and take them off out of their, you know, horrible circumstances on some fantastic adventure. And I always wanted to tell a story like that. And I also love stories about eccentric billionaires who, you know, hold a contest. Like there are several movies that I loved as a kid that played on that theme, like Scavenger Hunt and It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World. And of course, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And there's another movie called Brewster's Millions also that had a kind of an eccentric billionaire holding a strange contest. So I love Roald Dahl, and I love that idea.
I'm betraying my video game ignorance, but in the book you call this an Easter egg. I guess this is a common term in video games?
It is. Yeah, and, you know, it's inspired by, you know, real Easter eggs. The idea is that an Easter egg is something in a video game, and they're also on DVDs, and, you know, some people would even say Beatles albums, you know, have Easter eggs, like those, you know, messages hidden on Beatles albums if you play them backwards in certain, you know, which I don't know if those actually exist, but
I don't know. I tried that. I never heard anything.
I never did either. It sounded pretty thin to me, but that was actually where the video game designer who created the very first Easter egg got the idea for his Easter egg was from a Beatles album. A man who worked for Atari and made games for the Atari 2600 back in the 70s named Warren Robinette. Back then, Atari didn't give their video game designers credit for their work. So the person who created a video game, their name didn't appear anywhere on the package or anywhere in the game itself. And that was really frustrating for him. So he created a secret room inside his adventure game with a secret key. And if you found this secret key, you could go into this room and his name was hidden there. And Atari didn't know that he had done this. And they made thousands of copies of the game and shipped it all over the world. And they didn't find out, you know, that Robinette had hidden his name inside the game until kids all over the world started to find it and, you know, send in letters describing how they had found it. And I was one of those kids that found it. And I've, you know, since met a lot of other people who found it. And there was something really incredibly exciting about that, like the secret that had been left there by the original video game designer that no one else knew about. And he left it there for me to find. And when I did, I felt this connection with the video game designer. So that idea that stuck with me, and that idea, you know, played a big role in my book. That's kind of the inspiration for the Eccentric Billionaires contest in Ready Player One. He's hidden this secret room somewhere inside this giant sprawling virtual reality, and whatever kid finds it, you know, will inherit his fortune and control of his company, and therefore control of the whole virtual world itself. So it's, you know, kind of the biggest lottery ticket imaginable. And since all of the puzzles and riddles that have to be unlocked to win this huge fortune deal with, you know, the pop culture of this billionaire's childhood, you know, he's made all the puzzles and riddles deal with stuff that he's obsessed with. And that's the stuff of, you know, of his childhood, of the 1970s and 80s and classic video games and John Hughes movies and bands like Rush and Duran Duran that he used to love. So you have all these kids in the future who end up becoming obsessed with the past and studying the past so they can unlock these so they can unlock these riddles. And that's the general gist of Ready Player One.
That's interesting, because I'm thinking about what earlier generations might say about the common culture that unifies their generation. You know, for instance, kids whose formative years were more the 60s or early 70s, the unifying thing that brought them together could very well have been politics, the anti-war movement, maybe the first countercultural music. So that had a kind of political edge to it. Does it bother you that you're saying that what unifies your generation is a popular culture that was created by corporations?
Well, yeah, and I think that's definitely the case, you know, created by, you know, not just corporations, but also musicians and filmmakers and, you know, really talented filmmakers like John Hughes. You know, like, he is arguably the most influential filmmaker of my childhood, and his movies, you know, had a really deep, like, resonating effect with a huge cross-section of my generation. And I think part of that, and I don't think it's completely void of political, I think the one big political factor of the 80s, and that kind of is the shadow that hangs over all of, you know, late 70s and 1980s culture, is the Cold War. And I think one of the reasons my generation is maybe so fixated or fascinated with the pop culture and the cartoons and, you know, kind of all of the totems of our childhood is during that whole decade, we, you know, from the time we were little kids, we were kind of warned that the world could end at any moment. We all grew up in the shadow of these two superpowers kind of teetering on the brink of collapse. There was no subtlety about it. I remember watching like the made-for-TV movie The Day After that was directed by Nicholas Meyer, which was kind of this big television event. And it was really, you know, I had nightmares for months afterwards as a result of, you know, just this fear of World War III happening at any time. So, I mean, none of that overtly political stuff is in my book, but I feel like the Cold War and that kind of sense of impending dread or worry about the end of the world maybe is one of the reasons that my generation has this accelerated nostalgia and is kind of so attached to the totems of their youth, is because they were so important to us and such an important distraction from this, you know, cynical, teetering on the brink of apocalypse worldview. But, you know, that's just a theory.
Ernest Cline is a screenwriter and the author of Ready Player One. He talked with Anne Strainchamps. I'm Jim Fleming. Coming up next, the story of homesickness. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin System eCampus, providing access to online degree programs and certificates offered by the 26 campuses of the UW system. Information is at ecampus.wisconsin.edu.
As Thomas Wolfe wrote, you can't go home again. But why do so many of us long to return home? Historian Susan J. Matt has some ideas. She's the author of Homesickness, An American History. As Matt writes in her book, the feeling we call homesickness has been around for centuries, but for a long time there wasn't really a word for it.
Homesickness comes into the English language in the 1750s, but nostalgia definitely signified a more acute case of the condition. You could have homesickness and survive it, but your chances weren't very good if you had nostalgia. Doctors would furrow their brows and worry about the outcome of your condition, so much so that many believed the only cure, if you had a real case of nostalgia, was to send the sufferer home. That was the only way to avoid death.
Wow. And that, of course, became even more acute later on during the Civil War, for instance.
Right. Just an amazing chapter when nostalgia really comes out on the scene in full glory, if you will. People had been using the diagnosis for the previous 60 or 70 years, but it's very widespread during the Civil War, as so much of the nation is facing the fact that fathers or sons or brothers are away from them. It becomes a national preoccupation, and you'll have very high-ranking military officers worried that they themselves might succumb to nostalgia. You'll have orders that military bands shouldn't play Home Sweet Home because it might make soldiers weepy and eventually homesick and eventually nostalgic, and then they would die. So there are some very strange precautions that come into place as a result of this fear. And I think it indicates that while we're a nation that celebrates mobility, we weren't all that used to it. Even though large numbers of people left home, nobody was finding it easy.
But this was sort of the end of the tolerance for nostalgia as a diagnosis, wasn't it? The Civil War was a kind of dividing moment in the history of homesickness.
That's right. You begin to see a growing impatience with it by the late 19th century. The diagnosis will continue up through World War II of soldiers having nostalgia, of civilians having nostalgia. But there's less cultural tolerance of it. For instance, people are told that the ambitious and successful will not be nostalgic or overly homesick because that would prevent them from going off and seeking opportunity. In an age when social Darwinism was gaining traction in American thought, the idea that people couldn't adapt to new environments was seen as a dreadful flaw, perhaps a biological weakness. So homesickness began to be a marker of inferiority and a sign that you might perish.
You have all of the millions, frankly, of immigrants who came into the country, especially at the end of the 1800s, the beginning of the 1900s, came by choice and in many cases came to enjoy the place they had come to while at the same time experiencing homesickness.
Absolutely. You see incredibly high rates of return among those immigrants who most people say set off with the idea that they would be able to go back home easily and often. Among Southern Italians, 56% of immigrants went home and stayed home. 30% of Poles went home. Close to 50% of Greeks went home and stayed home. In the age of the steamship, the decision to migrate didn't seem so consequential. So people said, well, I'll come to America, I'll make some money, I'll go home. Some of them do, some of them don't, and stay on in America, but they end up having a dual identity and they aren't quite sure where home is. And that becomes an increasingly common sentiment in American life.
So how did they deal with being here? Did they try to recreate home in a new place?
Yes, exactly. You see so many of those ethnic colonies that spring up in the big cities of America, where you can go and not hear a word of English spoken. It will be an all-Italian community with Italian newspapers, Italian food, or Greek food. They'll create restaurants for the men in their community who have come without their wives and can't cook the dishes of home for themselves. You'll have all sorts of fraternal organizations designed to keep you in touch with others from your village or city. These groups often sponsor trips home, and some people will take those trips and stay. Some will just come back and forth for visits. But these ethnic communities become a real oasis where you can feel that you haven't really left home. And they'll even be organized down to the village level so that little hamlets in Poland will be recreated in Chicago.
Is this what you mean when you write about the split between nostalgia and homesickness, that nostalgia has become an antidote to homesickness?
Well, increasingly, people discover that they really can't go home again. And that's kind of the basis of our modern sense of nostalgia. I think technology had a lot to do with that, when you could take the steamship home and go to your village and realize that it had changed during your absence and you had changed during your absence, or take the Transcontinental Railroad home and see that your little town in Massachusetts wasn't what you remembered. People realized they couldn't go home again. And that became this new sense of nostalgia, that what people are longing for today is a lost past. And home is located somewhere in that past, but it's irretrievable. In contrast, the homesick want a lost place that they can go back to. It's only a gulf of geography that separates them, whereas the nostalgic is separated by a gulf of time. In modern society, I think because homesickness is a disruptive emotion, a lot of people make do with mementos of the past, with indulging in kind of nostalgic indulgences, whether it's vacations, purchases of retro cars or retro houses. These icons of the past are supposed to make you have a sense of roots, feel connected and stable, even if you're far from the home you once occupied.
Is it different now, especially with all of the social media tools that we have available to us? The internet, of course, bringing us in some ways closer to the people we left behind.
Definitely, it's changed the experience of immigration. It's changed the experience of military service. It's changed the experience of college. All of these were experiences that used to be rife with homesickness. When college students left home, they would be beset by homesickness in their first month or two of a new college career. When soldiers went off, they too would feel it, certainly immigrants. What numerous scholars have documented is how the internet has changed that and how cell phones have changed that. And people are certainly in more contact than they were with their families before such technologies existed. And I think the incredible popularity of texting, of Facebook, of email, of cell phones is testament to how much people want to stay in touch and how present that longing for family and place is. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I'm not sure that technology actually solves the problem of homesickness. It gives the illusion of closeness, but you're still not there. And sometimes that fact is brought all the more clearly to you when you can call home and hear the family gathered, as one Mexican immigrant family told me. When you can call home and hear everybody having Sunday dinner and you're in San Diego and they're in southern Mexico, yes, you're connected to them, but you're also so aware of how far away you are.
Throughout its history, of course, there have been these conflicting views. It's a virtue to some. It's a weakness to others. Is there a right way to view homesickness? Is there a way you think that we can most healthfully view homesickness?
Well, I do think that a lot of the alarm we hear today about children being too connected to their parents, all the discussion of boomerang kids, helicopter parents, that there isn't enough distance between them, is based on a mythic view of our past that somewhere back in a different century, we were more individualistic than we are. And I think a history of homesickness kind of puts that in perspective and gives the lie to that mythology, because earlier generations were just as eager for contact with their parents, just as full of the desire to be in constant connection. During the Civil War, people talk about how hundreds of young men would be writing letters to their mother if you looked around any army camp at any given time. And I think of that often when I look around and see people on their iPhones and computers constantly networked. I don't think we're that much different from earlier generations. And I don't think we should perhaps worry that we're becoming soft or less independent or less individualistic, because I'm not at all convinced we were that individualistic 100 years ago, 150 years ago.
Susan J. Matt is a historian at Weber State University in Ogden, Utah, and the author of Homesickness, An American History. Coming up, why music's addiction to the past may be killing its future. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and Public Radio International. If pop culture is all about the next big thing, Why does so much of today's culture celebrate the past? We are inundated with band reunion tours, expanded reissues of classic albums, and endless movie remakes. Music critic Simon Reynolds is the author of Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. In the book, Reynolds argues that we've reached a tipping point on our capacity for artistic nostalgia. But even so, he told Steve Paulson that earlier eras had their own obsessions with the past. For example, the Renaissance.
They have a few fragments, and they have the writing, and they have these broken sculptures, and that's all they have really to go on. So there's a lot more invention, I think, involved, although they're romanticizing the past, obviously. And I think that's a current that goes through human history, is often a lot of cultures and societies feel like the past was the golden age and we're fallen in some way. So that aspect is not new. What is new, I think, is this sort of fixation on the immediate past, you know, the sort of way the material is available to us in terms of film footage, videos, images of the stars and the clothes they wore, and also just the recordings, you know, and that means that retro is a lot more exact in its copying of the past.
Hmm. So there's actually a certain faithfulness to copying it. It's not just sort of, I don't know, blandly drawing on certain influences from, let's say, the 1980s. It's actually, you know, really knowing what was going on there and kind of making an exact copy of it in certain ways.
Yeah, I mean, the people, you know, if you look at an artist like LaRue, she's gone to some trouble to get that 80s synth sound, you know, and actually have the limitations of the music at that time. So you could get a much less rigid sort of rhythm these days with modern technology. But she's gone for that certain kind of stiff electronic sound, you know, those simple sequenced electronic patterns. Obviously, she loves that period of music. People can do it more creative than other people, and people kind of shuffle fragments from different eras and different sort of stylistic traits and things together to make interesting results. One thing that I do in the book is I actually look at rock's own history of revivalism and looking back. It did start quite early. The first major wave of it was in the early 70s when you had the 50s rock and roll nostalgia wave, and that was in music with Shannon R, and John Lennon did some very basic stripped-down 50s-inspired music. But you also had it in movies with American Graffiti, you had Happy Days series. It was a sort of culture-wide moment of, I guess the 70s was a quite dark and depressing time, and also music had got kind of very sophisticated. So there was a kind of nostalgia for the simplicity and seeming innocence of rock and roll.
Now, what you've done here with your book Retromania is more than just survey what's been going on. You're making an argument here that there's something bad about all of this. I mean, you're saying that, really, this is we're losing originality, or many artists today really don't know how to be original because they keep just mining the past.
Yeah, I mean, I see it a lot with new bands where it's very easy to see their reference points. But also, you know, you read an interview with them, practically the first thing they do is they reel out their reference points. It's almost become like a mode of creativity or recreativity, really, because they're more like curators or editors in the sense that they sift through all this material because it's there and it's super accessible.
Give me some examples of this.
Well, some of these people who do it, you know, I rather enjoy. There's an artist called Destroyer. His new album, Kaput, is actually not typical of all his work, but he's done an album that's very closely inspired by the sort of mid-80s glossy intelligent pop of people like Prefab Sprout and the Blue Note. There's also a bit of a Roxy Music kind of vibe. Like, he's very deliberately gone for these 80s mid-80s expensively produced signifiers. Like, he has sax solos. Apparently sax solos are coming back in a sort of kind of ironic yet at the same time genuinely enjoyed kind of way as an 80s reference point. The kind of sax solo you would get in a Hall & Oates song or certain Roxy Music songs from that time. It's actually a really enjoyable record. I really enjoy it. But it's interesting that that's how a lot of intelligent young musicians operate in this sort of way of sifting through the past and piecing together an identity, and even doing it in a specific way for one project.
So are you saying then that today's musicians just don't know how to create new art because they're so obsessed with the past? I mean, with all these musical references, with this keen sense of history, but maybe in the process losing the ability to make something new?
I think that there's a certain sense in which I think people are overpowered by the abundance of all this archival material.
But they don't have to obsess over it. I mean, they could still go off, as artists for eons have done, to create something new.
Well, perhaps it's hard to when you're mentally crowded out by all these images. In the art world, these were issues that a lot of artists faced. For instance, there was this movement called the appropriation art, the pictures generation. And there was an artist called Sherry Levine who did these pictures that were kind of famous pictures that she reproduced, and then she put her signature on them, and they were called After Egon Schiele or After Walker Evans. And she had a manifesto that was all about how the modern artist is flooded with images. They've almost kind of glutted with the wealth of painting and the art from the past. Her art was about that. It was actually addressing this issue of how to find something new to say in a sort of cultural environment where you're just flooded with material, you know.
Mm-hmm. You write about something that I'd never heard of before, hauntology. Can you explain what this is?
I'll try and keep it simple. It gets quite labyrinthine. But, I mean, hauntology is this term that actually Jacques Derrida came up with, and it was specifically to do with the idea that Marx, although communism was considered dead, the ghost of Marx stalks our culture as this kind of reproachful figure. The idea of equality and the sharing of wealth and all these things that an ideal form of Marxism represented, you know, that is still a reproach to the world, even despite the declaration of the end of history and the triumph of liberal capitalism. Hauntology's had this resonance outside philosophy and political theory. It's been picked up by artists. There's a lot of artists who are using ideas to do with haunting, memory, ruins, you know, all these sort of slightly morbid and bleak-seeming concepts.
Well, isn't there a more practical part of this as well? I mean, people who sort of, you know, go through resale shops looking for certain kinds of items?
Yes, it relates to vintage chic and thrifting. There's a concept, dead media, that the science fiction writer Bruce Sterling came up with, which is a sort of fascination for obsolete forms of technology. And actually, a musical example of this is there were a lot of bands recently that had the word tape or cassettes in their names. Some of them actually used cassette as their primary format, partly for nostalgia reasons, partly because they actually liked the sound, this sort of blurry sound you get with cassettes. It's warmer than the clean digital sound of CDs or downloads. But recently I noticed there's a band called Fax Machine. So the Fax Machine has actually joined the company of dead media now. It's like an obsolete, antique-seeming form. Because, you know, I can't remember the last time I used a fax machine. And they do have this period vibe. They make you think, of the 90s, which is people are starting to be nostalgic about.
Who would have thought?
Yeah.
You write about a Scottish duo called the Boards of Canada, which you say was the immediate ancestor of the UK hauntologists.
Yes, well, the Boards of Canada is a kind of, the name itself is referring to these educational movies that they used to see as children, the brothers who were behind Boards of Canada. So that has an association with sort of childhood, school, the kind of sense of wonder that you had for nature documentaries and scientific programs showing microbes or whatever. Those kind of associations is what they're playing on. But also the sounds they use are often very deliberately sort of faded and distressed and have a kind of quality that's actually like a sonic equivalent of like old Super 8 childhood movies, you know, where they've kind of mottled with colour and are fading a bit or yellowing. You know, I listen to the Boards of Canada and it has this really potent effect on me, partly because some of the sounds they use remind you of the music in these sort of educational movies or children's TV programs of the 70s when I was a kid. Synthesizer sounds that kind of have this, it's a bit like Proust's Madeleine cake, you know, where the character bites into the cake and all these memories flood back. Listening to their music has that effect, the eerie effect of memories coming to my head, images from childhood. And I think this is what a lot of these groups are playing on. The sort of sounds they use change as different waves of bands are coming forward, like bands where their childhood is the 80s or the early 90s. They use sort of different electronic sounds, more redolent maybe of the early video games or whatever. It's an interesting thing to see nostalgia being used creatively as well.
Well, it seems that there's a paradox at the center of everything that you're saying here. On the one hand, you say this is lame and shameful. I mean, sort of this obsession with, you know, mining the past. But you clearly enjoy a lot of this too.
Yeah, it's a conflicted book. I'm always interested in innovation and stuff I've never heard of, you know, that sounds like I've never heard anything like it before. And I'm always looking for that sort of future rush is what I call it in the book. But at the same time, I'm deeply nostalgic person and could happily spend hours on YouTube.
So when you look into your crystal ball, do you think this rerun culture or this retro culture will just keep going on forever, or will it end at some point? And if so, what will bring it to an end?
Well, one thing actually that could bring it to an end, I think to some extent, will be the decline of a thrift store economy. If more and more books and music only exists in digital form, you don't need to throw it away, and you can't throw it away, and you can't sell it on. So at a certain point, there'll be a cutoff point. Thrift stores and flea markets and similar places will only have 20th century pre-digital analog era material. Maybe that stuff will carry on having an interest. But I think also maybe a new breed of people will come along who've never owned culture in a physical form and won't have any interest in cluttering up their lives. They'll want to be mobile. They'll want to have empty apartments. As the cloud develops, people won't even own the stuff inside their computers. It'll be up there somewhere. Perhaps that interest in collecting and picking over the past will go.
The past inside the present.
Simon Reynolds is the author of Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 102A, Rerun Culture. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon and Veronica Rickert, with help from Ann Strainchamps and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.